Chapter 9. McEachern lay in bed. The room was dark, but he wasn't asleep. He lay beside Mrs. McEachern, whom he did believe to be sleeping, thinking fast and hard, thinking, the suit has been worn. But when? It could not have been during the day, because he is beneath my eyes, except on Saturday afternoons. But on any Saturday afternoon, he could go to the barn, remove and hide the fit clothing which I require him to wear, and then don apparel which he would and could need only as some adjunct to sinning. It was as if he knew then, had been told. That would infer, then, that the garments were worn in secret, and therefore, in all likelihood, at night. And if that were so, he refused to believe that the boy had other than one purpose, lechery. He had never committed lechery himself, and he hadn't once failed to refuse to listen to anyone who talked about it. Yet within about 30 minutes of intensive thinking, he knew almost as much of Joe's doings as Joe himself could have told him, with the exception of names and places. Very likely he wouldn't have believed those, even from Joe's mouth, since men of his kind usually have just as firmly fixed convictions about the mechanics, the theatering of evil, as about those of good. Thus bigotry and clairvoyance were practically one. Only the bigotry was a little slow, for as Joe, descending on his rope, slid like a fast shadow across the open and moon-filled window behind which McEachern lay, McEachern didn't at once recognize him, or perhaps believe what he saw, even though he could see the very rope itself. And when he got to the window, Joe had already drawn the rope back and made it fast, and was now on his way toward the barn. As McEachern watched him from the window, he felt something of that pure and impersonal outrage which a judge must feel were he to see a man on trial for his life lean and spit on the bailiff's sleeve. Hidden in the shadows of the lane halfway between the house and the road, he could see Joe at the mouth of the lane. He, too, heard the car and saw it come up and stop and Joe get into it. Possibly he didn't even care who else was in it. Perhaps he already knew, and his purpose had been merely to see in which direction it went. Perhaps he believed that he knew that, too, since the car could have gone almost anywhere in a country full of possible destinations, with roads that led to them. Because he now turned back toward the house, walking fast, in that same pure and impersonal outrage, as if he believed so that he would be guided by some greater and purer outrage, that he wouldn't even need to doubt personal faculties. In carpet slippers, without a hat, his nightshirt thrust into his trousers and his braces dangling, he went straight as an arrow to the stable and saddled his big, old, strong white horse, and returned back down the lane and to the road at a heavy gallop, though Mrs. McEachern from the kitchen door called his name when he rode out of the lot. He turned into the road at that slow and ponderous gallop, the two of them, man and beast, leaning a little stiffly forward, as though in some juggernautish simulation of terrific speed, though the actual speed itself was absent, as if in that cold and implacable and undeviating conviction of both omnipotence and clairvoyance, of which they both partook, known destination and speed weren't necessary. He rode at that same speed straight to the place which he sought, and which he'd found out of a whole night and almost a whole half of a county, though it wasn't that far distant. He'd gone hardly 4 miles when he heard music ahead, and then he saw, beside the road lights in a schoolhouse, a one-room building. He'd known where the building was, but he'd had neither reason nor manner of knowing that there would be a dance held in it. But he rode straight to it, and into the random shadows of parked cars and buggies and saddled horses and mules which filled the grove which surrounded the school, and dismounted almost before the horse had stopped. He didn't even tether it. He got down, and in the carpet slippers and the dangling braces and his round head and his short, blunt, outraged beard, ran toward the open door and the open windows where the music came and where kerosene-lit shadows passed in a certain orderly uproar. Perhaps, if he were thinking at all, he believed that he'd been guided and were now being propelled by some militant Michael himself as he entered the room. Apparently his eyes weren't even momentarily at fault with the sudden light and the motion as he thrust among bodies with turned heads as, followed by a wake of astonishment and incipient pandemonium, he ran toward the youth whom he'd adopted of his own free will and whom he'd tried to raise as he was convinced was right. Joe and the waitress were dancing, and Joe hadn't seen him yet. The woman had never seen him but once, but perhaps she remembered him, or perhaps his appearance now was enough, because she stopped dancing, and upon her face came an expression very like horror, which Joe saw and turned. As he turned, McEachern was upon them. Neither had McEachern ever seen the woman but once, and very likely then he hadn't looked at her, just as he'd refused to listen when men spoke of fornication. Yet he went straight to her, ignoring Joe for the moment. "Away, Jezebel," he said. His voice thundered into the shocked silence, the shocked surrounding faces beneath the kerosene lamps, into the ceased music, into the peaceful moonlit night of young summer. "Away, harlot!" Perhaps it didn't seem to him that he'd been moving fast, nor that his voice was loud. Very likely he seemed to himself to be standing just and rock-like and with neither haste nor anger, while on all sides the sluttishness of weak human man seethed in a long sigh of terror about the actual representative of the wrathful and retributive throne. Perhaps they weren't even his hands which struck at the face of the youth whom he'd nurtured and sheltered and clothed from a child. And perhaps when the face ducked a blow and came up again, it wasn't the face of that child. But he couldn't have been surprised at that, since it wasn't that child's face which he was concerned with. It was the face of Satan, which he knew as well. And when, staring at the face, he walked steadily toward it with his hand still raised, very likely he walked toward it in the furious and dreamlike exultation of a martyr who's already been absolved, into the descending chair which Joe swung at his head, and into nothingness. Perhaps the nothingness astonished him a little, but not much, and not for long. Then to Joe, it all rushed away, roaring, dying, leaving him in the center of the floor, the shattered chair clutched in his hand, looking down at his adopted father. McEachern lay on his back. He looked quite peaceful now. He appeared to sleep, blunt-headed, indomitable, even in repose, even the blood on his forehead, peaceful and quiet. Joe was breathing hard. He could hear it, and also something else, thin and shrill and far away. He seemed to listen to it for a long time before he recognized it for a voice, a woman's voice. He looked and saw two men holding her, and she writhing and struggling, her hair shaken forward, her white face wrung and ugly beneath the splotches of savage paint, her mouth a small jagged hole filled with shrieking. "Calling me a harlot!" she screamed, wrenching at the men who held her. "That old son of a bitch! Let go! Let go!" Then her voice stopped making words again and just screamed. She writhed and threshed, trying to bite the hands of the men who struggled with her. Still carrying the shattered chair, Joe walked toward her. About the walls, huddling, clotted, the others watched him. The girls in stiff off-colors and mail-order stockings and heels. The men, young men in ill-cut and board-like garments, also from the mail-order, with hard, ruined hands and eyes already revealing a heritage of patient brooding upon endless furrows and the slow buttocks of mules. Joe began to run, brandishing the chair. "Let her go," he said. At once she ceased struggling and turned on him the fury, the shrieking, as if she'd just seen him, realized that he was also there. "And you brought me here. Goddamn bastard, clodhopper bastard, you. Son of a bitch, you and him too, putting him at me that never ever saw." Joe didn't appear to be running at anyone in particular, and his face was quite calm beneath the uplifted chair. The others fell back from about the woman, freeing her, though she continued to wrench her arms as if she didn't yet realize it. "Get out of here," Joe shouted. He whirled, swinging the chair, yet his face was still quite calm. "Back," he said, though no one had moved toward him at all. They were all as still and as silent as the man on the floor. He swung the chair, backing now toward the door. "Stand back. I said I would kill him some day. I told him so." He swung the chair about him, calm-faced, backing toward the door. "Don't one of you move now," he said, looking steadily and ceaselessly at faces that might have been masks. Then he flung the chair down and whirled and sprang out the door into soft, dappled moonlight. He overtook the waitress as she was getting into the car in which they'd come. He was panting, yet his voice was calm, too. A sleeping face merely breathing hard enough to make sounds. "Get on back to town," he said. "I'll be there as soon as I..." Apparently he wasn't aware of what he was saying, nor of what was happening. When the woman turned suddenly in the door of the car and began to beat him in the face, he didn't move. His voice didn't change. "Yes, that's right. I'll be there as soon as I..." Then he turned and ran while she was still striking at him. He couldn't have known where McEachern had left the horse, nor for certain if it was even there. Yet he ran straight to it, with something of his adopted father's complete faith in an infallibility in events. He got onto it and swung it back toward the road. The car had already turned into the road. He saw the taillight diminish and disappear. The old, strong, farm-bred horse returned home at its slow and steady canter. The youth upon its back rode lightly, balanced lightly, leaning well forward, exulting perhaps at that moment, as Faustus had, of having put behind now, at once and for all, the "shalt not," of being free at last of honor and law. In the motion the sweet, sharp sweat of the horse blew, sulfuric. The invisible wind flew past. He cried aloud, "I have done it! I have done it! I told them I would!" He entered the lane and rode through the moonlight up to the house without slowing. He'd thought it would be dark, but it wasn't. He didn't pause. The careful and hidden rope were as much a part of his dead life now as honor and hope. And the old wearying woman, who'd been one of his enemies for 13 years, and who was now awake, waiting for him. The light was in hers and McEachern's bedroom, and she was standing in the door, with a shawl over her nightdress. "Joe?" she said. He came down the hall fast. His face looked as McEachern had seen it as the chair fell. Perhaps she couldn't yet see it good. "What is it?" she said. "Pa rode away on the horse. I heard..." She saw his face then. but she didn't even have time to step back. He didn't strike her. His hand on her arm was quite gentle. It was just hurried, getting her out of the path, out of the door. He swept her aside as he might have a curtain across the door. "He's at a dance," he said. "Get away, old woman." She turned, clutching the shawl with one hand, her other against the door face as she fell back, watching him as he crossed the room and began to run up the stairs which mounted to his attic. Without stopping, he looked back. Then she could see his teeth shining in the lamp. "At a dance, you hear? He's not dancing, though." He laughed back into the lamp. He turned his head and his laughing, running on up the stairs, vanishing as he ran, vanishing upward from the head down as if he were running head first and laughing into something that was obliterating him, like a picture in chalk being erased from a blackboard. She followed, toiling up the stairs. She began to follow almost as soon as he passed her, as if that urgency which had carried her husband away had returned like a cloak on the shoulders of the boy and had been passed from him in turn to her. She dragged herself up the cramped stair, clutching the rail with one hand and the shawl with the other. She wasn't speaking, not calling to him. It was as though she were a phantom, obeying the command sent back by the absent master. Joe hadn't lighted his lamp, but the room was filled with refracted moon glow, and even without that, very likely she could have told what he was doing. She held herself upright by the wall, fumbling her hand along the wall until she reached the bed and sank onto it, sitting. It had taken her some time because when she looked toward where the loose plank was, he was already approaching toward the bed where the moonlight fell directly. And she watched him empty the tin can onto the bed and sweep the small mass of coins and bills into his hand and ram the hand into his pocket. Only then did he look at her as she sat, back fallen a little now, propped on one arm and holding the shawl with the other hand. "I didn't ask you for it," he said. "Remember that, I didn't ask. Because I was afraid you'd give it to me. I just took it. Don't forget that." He was turning almost before his voice ceased. She watched him turn into the lamplight which fell up the stair, descending. He passed out of sight, but she could still hear him. She heard him in the hall again, fast, and after a while she heard the horse again, galloping, and after a while the sound of the horse ceased. A clock was striking one somewhere when Joe urged the now spent old horse through the main street of town. The horse had been breathing hard for some time now, but Joe still held it at a stumbling trot with a heavy stick that fell rhythmically across its rump. It wasn't a switch. It was a section of broom handle which had been driven into Mrs. McEachern's flower bed in front of the house for something to grow on. Though the horse was still going through the motion of galloping, it wasn't moving much faster than a man could walk. The stick, too, rose and fell with the same spent and terrific slowness, the youth on the horse's back leaning forward as if he didn't know that the horse had flagged, or as though to lift forward and onward the failing beast whose slow hooves rang with a measured hollow sound through the empty and moon-dappled street. It, the horse and the rider, had a strange, dreamy effect, like a moving picture in slow motion as it galloped steady and flagging up the street and toward the old corner where he used to wait, less urgent perhaps, but not less eager, and more young. The horse wasn't even trotting now. On stiff legs, its breathing deep and labored and rasping, each breath a groan. The stick still fell as the progress of the horse slowed. The speed of the stick increased, in exact ratio. But the horse slowed, shearing in to the curb. Joe pulled at its head, beating it, but it slowed into the curb and stopped, shadow-dappled, its head down, trembling, its breathing almost like a human voice. Yet still the rider leaned forward in the arrested saddle in the attitude of terrific speed, beating the horse across the rump with the stick. Save for the rise and fall of the stick and the groaning respirations of the animal, they might have been an equestrian statue strayed from its pedestal and come to rest in an attitude of ultimate exhaustion in a quiet and empty street, splotched and dappled by moon shadows. Joe descended. He went to the horse's head and began to tug it, as if he would drag it into motion by main strength, and then spring onto its back. The horse didn't move. He desisted. He seemed to be leaning a little toward the horse. Again they were motionless, the spent beast and the youth facing one another, their heads quite near, as if carved in an attitude of listening or of prayer or of consultation. Then Joe raised the stick and fell to beating the horse about its motionless head. He beat it steadily until the stick broke. He continued to strike it with a fragment not much longer than his hand, but perhaps he realized that he was inflicting no pain, or perhaps his arm grew tired at last because he threw the stick away and turned, whirled, already in full stride. He didn't look back. Diminishing, his white shirt pulsing and fading in the moon shadows, he ran as completely out of the life of the horse as if it had never existed. He passed the corner where he used to wait. If he noticed, thought at all, he must have said, "My God, how long ago that was." The street curved into the gravel road. He had almost a mile yet to go, so he ran not fast, but carefully, steadily. His face lowered a little as if he contemplated the spurned road beneath his feet, his elbows at his sides like a trained runner. The road curved on, moon-blanched, bordered at wide intervals by the small, random, new, terrible little houses in which people who came yesterday from nowhere and tomorrow will be gone where not dwell on the edges of towns. They were all dark, save the one toward which he ran. He reached the house and turned from the road, running, his feet measured and loud in the late silence. Perhaps he could see already the waitress, in a dark dress for traveling, with her hat on and her bag packed, waiting. How they were to go anywhere, by what means depart, likely he'd never thought. And perhaps Max and Mame, too, likely undressed. Mac coatless, or maybe even in his undershirt, and Mame in the light blue kimono. The two of them bustling about in that loud, cheerful, seeing someone off way. But actually he wasn't thinking at all, since he'd never told the waitress to get ready to leave at all. Perhaps he believed that he'd told her, or that she would know, since his recent doings and his future plans must have seemed to him simple enough for anyone to understand. Perhaps he even believed that he'd told her he was going home in order to get money when she got into the car. He ran onto the porch. Heretofore, even during his heyday in the house, his impulse had been always to glide from the road and into the shadow of the porch and into the house itself, where he was expected, as swiftly and inconspicuously as possible. He knocked. There was a light in her room, and another at the end of the hall, as he'd expected, and voices from beyond the curtained windows, too, several voices which he could discern to be intent rather than cheerful. That he expected, too, thinking, "Perhaps they think I'm not coming. That damn horse, that damn horse." He knocked again, louder, putting his hand on the knob, shaking it, pressing his face against the curtained glass in the front door. The voices ceased. Then there was no sound whatever from within the house. The two lights, the lighted shade to her room and the opaque curtain in the door, burned with a steady and unwavering glare, as if all the people in the house had suddenly died when he touched the knob. He knocked again, with scarce interval between. He was still knocking when the door, no shadow had fallen upon the curtain and no step had approached beyond it, fled suddenly and silently from under his wrapping hand. He was already stepping across the threshold as if he were attached to the door when Max emerged from behind it, blocking it. He was completely dressed, even to the hat. "Well, well, well," he said. His voice wasn't loud, and it was almost as if he'd drawn Joe swiftly into the hall and shut the door and locked it before Joe knew that he was inside. Yet his voice held again that ambiguous quality, that quality hearty and completely empty and completely without pleasure or mirth, like a shell, like something carried before his face and watched Joe through it, which in the past had caused Joe to look at Max with something between puzzlement and anger. "Here's Romeo at last," he said. "The Beale Street playboy." Then he spoke a little louder, saying Romeo quite loud. "Come in and meet the folks." Joe was already moving toward the door, which he knew, very nearly running again, if he'd ever actually stopped. He wasn't listening to Max. He'd never heard of Beale Street, that three or four Memphis city blocks in comparison with which Harlem is a movie set. Joe hadn't looked at anything, because suddenly he saw the blonde woman standing in the hall at the rear. He hadn't seen her emerge into the hall at all, yet it was empty when he entered. Then suddenly she was standing there. She was dressed in a dark skirt, and she held a hat in her hand. And just beyond an open dark door beside him was a pile of luggage, several bags. Perhaps he didn't see them. Or perhaps, looking, saw once, faster than thought. I didn't think she'd had that many. Perhaps he thought then for the first time that they had nothing to travel in, thinking, how can I carry all those? But he didn't pause, already turning toward the door, which he knew. It was only as he put his hand on the door that he became aware of complete silence beyond it. A silence which he, at 18, knew that it would take more than one person to make. But he didn't pause. Perhaps he wasn't even aware that the hall was empty again, that the blonde woman had vanished again without his having seen or heard her move. He opened the door. He was running now. That is, as a man might run far ahead of himself in his knowing, in the act of stopping stock still. The waitress sat on the bed as he'd seen her sitting so many times. She wore the dark dress and the hat as he'd expected, known. She sat with her face lowered, not even looking at the door when it opened, a cigarette burning in one still hand that looked almost monstrous in its immobility against the dark dress. And in the same instant, he saw the second man. He'd never seen the man before, but he didn't realize this now. It was only later that he remembered that, and remembered the piled luggage in the dark room which he'd looked at for an instant, while thought went faster than seeing. The stranger sat on the bed, too, also smoking. His hat was tipped forward so that the shadow of the brim fell across his mouth. He wasn't old, yet he didn't look young, either. He and Max might have been brothers in the sense that any two white men, strayed suddenly into an African village, might look like brothers to them who live there. His face, his chin where the light fell upon it, was still. Whether or not the stranger was looking at him, Joe didn't know, and that Max was standing just behind him, Joe didn't know either. And he heard their actual voices without knowing what they said, without even listening. Ask him. How would he know? Perhaps he heard the words, but likely not. Likely they were as yet no more significant than the rasping of insects beyond the close-drawn window or the packed bags which he'd looked at and had not yet seen. He cleared out right afterward, Bobby said. He might know. Let's find out if we can, just what we're running from at least. Though Joe hadn't moved since he entered, he was still running. When Max touched his shoulder, he turned as if he'd been halted in mid-stride. He hadn't been aware that Max was even in the room. He looked at Max over his shoulder with a kind of furious annoyance. "Let's have it, kid," Max said. "What about it?" "What about what?" Joe said. "The old guy. You think you croaked him? Let's have it straight. You don't want to get Bobby in a jam." "Bobby," Joe said, thinking, "Bobby. Bobby." He turned, running again. This time Max caught his shoulder, though not hard. "Come on," Max said. "Ain't we all friends here? Did you croak him?" "Croak him?" Joe said, in that fretted tone of impatience and restraint, as if he were being detained and questioned by a child. The stranger spoke. "The one you crowned with the chair, is he dead?" "Dead?" Joe said. He looked at the stranger. When he did so, he saw the waitress again, and he ran again. He actually moved now. He'd completely dismissed the two men from his mind. He went to the bed, dragging at his pocket, on his face an expression both exalted and victorious. The waitress didn't look at him. She hadn't looked at him once since he entered, though very likely he'd completely forgot that. She hadn't moved. The cigarette still burned in her hand. Her motionless hand looked as big and dead and pale as a piece of cooking meat. Again, someone grasped him by the shoulder. It was the stranger now. The stranger and Max stood shoulder to shoulder looking at Joe. "Quit stalling," the stranger said. "If you croak the guy, say so. Can't be any secret long. I'm bound to hear about it by next month at the outside." "I don't know, I tell you," Joe said. He looked from one to the other, fretted but not yet glaring. "I hit him. He fell down. I told him I was going to do it someday." He looked from one to the other of the still, almost identical faces. He began to jerk his shoulder under the stranger's hand. Max spoke. "What'd you come here for, then?" Joe said. He said in a tone of fainting amazement, glaring from face to face with a sort of outraged yet still patient exasperation. "What did I come for? I came to get Bobby. Do you think that when I went all the way home to get the money to get married..." Again he completely forgot. Dismissed them. He jerked free and turned to the woman, with once more that expression, oblivious, exalted, and proud. Very likely at that moment the two men were blown as completely out of his life as two scraps of paper. Very likely he wasn't even aware when Max went to the door and called, and a moment later the blonde woman entered. He was bending above the bed upon which sat the immobile and down-looking waitress, stooping above her, dragging the wadded mass of coins and bills from his pocket onto her lap and onto the bed beside her. "Here, Look at it, look. I've got, see? Then the wind blew upon him again. Like in the schoolhouse 3 hours ago, among the gaped faces there, of which he had for the first time been oblivious. He stood in a quiet, dreamlike state, erect now, where the upward spring of the sitting waitress had knocked him, and saw her, on her feet, gather up the wadded and scattered money and fling it. He saw quietly her face strained, the mouth screaming, the eyes screaming, too. He alone of them all seemed to himself quiet, calm. His voice alone quiet enough to register upon the ear. "You mean you won't?" he said. "You mean you won't?" It was very much like it had been in the schoolhouse. Someone holding her as she struggled and shrieked, her hair wild with the jerking and tossing of her head, her face, even her mouth, in contrast to the hair, as still as a dead mouth and a dead face. "Bastard! Son of a bitch! Get me into a jam that always treated you like you're a white man! A white man!" But very likely to him, even yet, it was just noise, not registering at all, just a part of the long wind. He just stared at her, at the face which he'd never seen before, saying quietly, whether aloud or not, he couldn't have said, in a slow amazement, "Why, I committed murder for her. I even stole for her." As if he'd just heard of it, thought of it, been told that he'd done it. Then she, too, seemed to blow out of his life on the long wind like a third scrap of paper. He began to swing his arm as if the hand still clutched the shattered chair. The blonde woman had been in the room some time. He saw her for the first time, without surprise, having apparently materialized out of thin air, motionless, with that diamond-surfaced tranquility which invested her with a respectability as implacable and calm as the white-lifted glove of a policeman. Not a hair out of place. She now wore the pale blue kimono over the dark garment for traveling. She said quietly, "Take him. Let's get out of here. There'll be a cop out here soon. They'll know where to look for him." Perhaps Joe didn't hear her at all, nor the screaming waitress. "He told me himself he's a nigger. Some bitch. Me, fucking for nothing, a nigger some bitch who would get me in a jam with clodhopper police at a clodhopper dance." Perhaps he heard only the long wind, as, swinging his hand as though it still clutched the chair, he sprang forward upon the two men. Very likely he didn't even know that they were already moving toward him, because with something of the exultation of his adopted father, he sprang full and of his own accord into the stranger's fist. Perhaps he didn't feel either blow, though the stranger struck him twice in the face before he reached the floor, where, like the man whom he had struck down, he lay upon his back, quite still. But he wasn't out, because his eyes were still open, looking quietly up at them. There was nothing in his eyes at all, no pain, no surprise. But apparently he couldn't move. He just lay there with a profoundly contemplative expression, looking quietly up at the two men, and the blonde woman still as immobile and completely finished and surfaced as a cast statue. Perhaps he couldn't hear the voices either, or perhaps he did, and they once more had no more significance than the dry buzzing of the steady insects beyond the window. "Bitching up as sweet a little set-up as I could have wanted. You ought to stay away from bitches. He can't help himself. He's born too close to one. Is he really a nigger? He don't look like one. That's what he told Bobby one night. But I guess she still don't know any more about what he is than he does. These country bastards are liable to be anything. We'll find out. We'll see if his blood is black. Lying peaceful and still, Joe watched the stranger lean down and lift his head from the floor and strike him again in the face, this time with a short, slashing blow. After a moment, he licked his lip a little, somewhat as a child might lick a cooking spoon. He watched the stranger's hand go back, but it didn't fall. That's enough. Let's get on to Memphis. Just one more. Joe lay quietly and watched the hand. Then Max was beside the stranger, stooping too. We'll need a little more blood to tell for sure. Sure. He don't need to worry. This one is on the house too. The hand didn't fall. Then the blonde woman was there too. She was holding the stranger's lifted arm by the wrist. I said that will do.